It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, almost half the seats in Wisconsin's legislature up for election this year either have no major party challenger or are completely uncontested. State Senator Tim Carpenter says Wisconsin needs to be able to vote against uncontested candidates with a none-of-the-above option.
First, UW students caught selling drugs on campus face expulsion and the loss of financial aid, but they can avoid criminal charges if they agree to help police bust other drug dealers. An investigation by Wisconsin Public Radio and the Center for Investigative Journalism raises questions about the risks of using students as confidential informants. Gilman Halstead reports.
The investigation included interviews with campus police chiefs as well as with several students who were arrested for dealing drugs and offered a deal to work as a drug informant. UW-Whitewater student Javonny Butler was suspended after he was arrested for selling a small amount of marijuana to an informant. He was offered the chance to reduce his felony charges and keep his record clean if he turned in other student dealers. But the 25-year-old who refused to talk on tape told Sean Kirkby of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism he resented being pressured to become a snitch. He ended up serving 45 days in jail. But UW-Whitewater Police Chief Matt Keterlin says last year 8 students did agree to the deal because it offers a significant benefit.
They don't end up with those charges or a conviction hanging over their head for the rest of their lives. And we certainly realize that a conviction for dealing narcotics can affect you in a lot of ways. We really do look at it as an opportunity for them to kind of pay back the mistake that they made.
But selling drugs, even when you're wearing a wire and police are watching, can be dangerous. Chief Keterlin says police do background checks on targeted drug dealers before sending a student out with marked bills to make a drug buy.
If we have someone that's shown a propensity towards violence, or maybe even a weapons charge or other things like that, we're not going to let them buy into that person because of the safety concern.
But UW-Oshkosh criminologist Stephen Richards says there are other safety concerns for informants that aren't included in their contract.
They're never warned about the downside. They're never warned about how there might be retaliation later. By helping themselves at the expense of others, which is what they're doing, they might, you know, get a lesser charge or even have the charge dropped. But they're going to be looking over their shoulder the rest of their lives.
Richards himself was caught in a federal sting operation and served 3 years in federal prison in the 1980s for conspiracy to sell marijuana. He says he turned down an offer to be an informant and pled not guilty because he believed marijuana should be legal and he didn't want to help arrest others for selling it. Now, as a law-abiding professor with a Ph.D., he sees using students as informants as counterproductive on a college campus.
I think it's detrimental to, you know, what we try to do on a college campus, which is to provide a safe and supportive environment for university students to learn. I think it disrupts that. It disrupts our mission.
UW-Whitewater Dean of Students Mary Beth Macon disagrees. She says when students break drug laws on campus, they shouldn't be treated differently just because they're students.
I think the important thing is this is not an anomaly to a college campus. It's the same thing that happens to a 19-year-old who's not come to college, who's working somewhere out in society.
UW-Whitewater Police Chief Keterlin says informants are helping. He says drug arrests on campus fell from 156 in 2012 to 94 last year. Both UW-Eau Claire and UW-Stout also use students for drug buys. Campuses in Green Bay and Oshkosh use informants only to obtain search warrants and subpoenas, not for drug buys. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're now joined by reporter Sean Kirkby of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, who led the report out yesterday. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what kind of crimes are these students committing that leads them into this position? They're facing a felony charge and offered a deal to be an informant instead.
Most of these students are selling small amounts of marijuana in the dorms and off campus. UW-Whitewater Police Chief Matt Keterlin says that most of the students that are arrested have marijuana dealing supplies as well as something else, such as a prescription medication or a harder drug. Under the state laws, marijuana distribution is a felony charge, and it carries anything from 0 to 200 grams is a felony and punishable by 3.5 years in jail and a $10,000 fine.
And apart from the legal consequences, there are risks to things like whether you can stay in school and eligibility for financial aid. Is that right?
Yeah. If you visit our website, wisconsinwatch.org, you'll see that we have a sidebar about this. And basically, the dealing drugs can result in a two-year period of ineligibility for federal financial aid for the first offense. And subsequent offenses can result in an indefinite period unless the student completes a drug rehabilitation program with two unannounced drug tests and or has their conviction voided. At UW-Whitewater, students can also be suspended for a period of up to 2 years from all UW system campuses.
Is this informant program something that we just see on Wisconsin campuses, or is this going on around the country as well?
It's really hard to tell because the use of informants is fairly unregulated across the nation. The New York Times recently reported on a program that was run through the Air Force Academy in Colorado that was using students as informants. And the New York Times also noted in that article that there are no known cases of other colleges using informants. But again, we don't know for sure.
And you mentioned a lack of regulation at the federal level. When campus police and other police are using these student informants, are they subject to state laws, I guess, or guidelines as to how they operate?
Not really. The only state laws that exist for informants in Wisconsin are usually aimed at protecting their identity, such as prohibiting police departments from releasing voice recordings, anything that could possibly identify an informant. There is only one state that I know of and that many experts know of that has a law regulating the use of informants, and that's Florida.
And there was an incident there, I think you mentioned in the story, where an informant was actually killed in the course of one of these drug buys.
Yeah, a 23-year-old college graduate named Rachel Hoffman had her apartment searched by police, and they found a few ounces of marijuana and some ecstasy pills. And they essentially sent her off to buy drugs while wearing a recording device. The operation backfired, and it resulted in her death and prompted the state to pass regulation requiring police departments to let informants know they have access to an attorney and other aspects.
Now, you, for this story, talked to some students who had been arrested and, in some cases, presented with this choice, felony charges, possible expulsion, loss of financial aid, or become an informant. How, talking to these people, how had they weighed that decision? Was it a tough call for them to make?
It was a very tough call for someone to make. One that I spoke to actually did accept an informant deal and then backed out of it because of concerns for his safety. Other people declined to accept the deal because they were concerned about what their friends would think. They didn't want to turn in their friends. And they were also concerned for their own safety, as well as some of them thought that marijuana should be legal.
And one of the arguments in favor of this that you quoted some university police officials saying, effectively, campus being a student is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. If you were an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old arrested for this and not a college student, you might be offered the same choice.
Yeah, that was so UW-Whitewater Police Chief Matt Kierlin and the UW Dean of Students brought up that point that basically this is no different than any kind of operation or any kind of deal that's offered to any person who has a felony conviction.
So how much criticism has there been of this? I know you talked to some academic experts who are concerned about the effect this has on a campus community. Is this a widespread concern or just a few people here and there are starting to raise it?
It's really becoming a few people here and there raising it. In the report at wisconsinwatch.org, I spoke to a nationally recognized expert, Alexandra Nadapoff, who teaches in Los Angeles, who feels that informants are being overused in the low-level war on drugs. And she specifically talked about that this is really a new phenomenon that's just beginning to be questioned. Mm-hmm. And she expects basically in 10 to 15 years that the landscape is going to be changing and there's going to be a lot more discussion about the tactics that police departments are using in these cases.
I mean, talking to the campus and police officials, are they making the case that this is making campuses more drug-free and safer to be on?
It's an interesting question because if you look at the arrest numbers that Gil mentioned in his report, you see that from 2012 to 2013, there was a decrease in crime on the UWYR campus from 156 arrests for drug violations to 94 mm-hmm. arrests, which the UWYR police chief attributes partially to the development of the informant program. The flip side of that is those are the highest arrest rates on campus for the past decade. Up until 2011, there were about 45 people being arrested in any given year, and now you've had this huge uptick. In addition, you have you're also making certain students who accept this kind of drug deal, you're placing them into potentially dangerous situations, such as Rachel Hoffman faced in Florida.
We'll leave it there for now. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with reporter Sean Kirkby of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. His report on UW schools using student informants in drug busts came out yesterday. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's Wisconsin Life. This week, we'll hear a piece about how trapping remains a way of life for some people, and then we'll talk about the archery deer hunting season.
First, imagine this. It's November 4th. You arrive at the polling station and head to a booth to cast your vote. You look down at the ballot and see a candidate you don't want to vote for, and they don't have a challenger. Or maybe you see a race in which there are two candidates. You don't want to vote for either of them. What do? You probably maybe don't vote in that race, or maybe you write in a candidate.
Well, Wisconsin Senator from Milwaukee, Tim Carpenter, wants to change that by adding a none-of-the-above option to Wisconsin ballots, a way to show the public and the government that you're unhappy with a candidate, even if they don't have a contestant that you like.
And in this fall's elections, that might be particularly relevant. Almost half of all open seats in Wisconsin's legislature have no major party challenger or are completely uncontested. That means of Wisconsin's 116 legislative seats in play, about 55, they're already decided.
Senator Carpenter is himself uncontested this fall and joins us now to make his case. And we'd also like to hear from you on this. Would you like to see this none-of-the-above option on Wisconsin ballots? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Senator, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So why do we need a none-of-the-above option on the ballot?
Well, I've been around politics for 30 years, and I've seen the general decline of our elections. And even though I'm unopposed myself, I feel there's a lot of voter apathy. If you look at Congress, they have approval rating of 10% in our Congress, but yet over 95% of them will get reelected. The stage is kind of rigged for incumbents to run for office. Because the advantages of incumbency, then you throw in money, third-party expenditures, independent expenditures, and a lot of voters don't feel like they have a say in anything. And as you pointed out, more than 50% of the races are unopposed for the state legislature, and I don't think anybody believes that everything's running hunky-dory here in Wisconsin. So it's in a way to measure, allow people to go ahead and register disapproval, or they want better government.
Do you see that as being something that, say, would be reported on election night? You know, say Rob Ferret runs for election, he wins, but he only gets 50% of the vote. The other 50% said none of the above. Is that something that would be, you know, accountable in the media?
I believe so. The first state to have it is Nevada. They started in 1976 after Watergate because they were concerned about voter apathy. And with them, they had eight men on the ballot for the race for governor. I'm happy to report, I guess, that 30% of the vote received was none of the above. The next candidate was at 25%, a gentleman by the name of Robert Goodman, who'd won twice before. So there's a stark example of people were not quite happy with the 8 Democratic candidates, and they voted for none of the above. I think that sends a very strong message to the politicians and for people in government. They're not happy. They're not happy with the product they're receiving.
Would anything happen if a candidate did receive an especially strong vote of no confidence?
It would be quite an embarrassment. I'm sure you'd go into Guinness Book of World Records, and what ends up happening is the candidate who came in second, this Robert Goodman, would go on to get the nomination. But it'd be one of those things that wouldn't be a ringing endorsement, and I would have a gut hunch that Mr. Goodman received the message, and I would almost guarantee you he's not the governor of Nevada.
Well, you yourself are running uncontested, as we said. Do you feel as though this would give you more feedback on the way that you're doing your job?
Oh, yeah. Constantly, since I've been in office, we have regular town hall meetings. We do questionnaires, go door to door, respond to phone calls, things of that nature. And we do that year round. I'm already starting to, I guess you could say, campaign for 2018. But a lot of elected officials don't even do newsletters or town hall meetings or anything of that nature. So politicians have big egos, no doubt about it. But I think it would be good for their egos if they found out, and I'd be certainly willing if someone wanted to, not only write in names like Mickey Mouse and things like that, it's only recorded as scattering. And it's a small number, but I would definitely would like to have a barometer of saying, okay, a certain percentage of people are not happy with me. And I would go about that and use that as a signal that things have got to change.
Is this going to make people feel better about voting because they get to express, a little bit more of their true opinion? Or is it just going to make voting that much more depressing?
Well, democracy is the worst form of government except all others. And in Milwaukee, I went to a baseball game on Saturday, and the Brewers have Hank the dog. I think you know of him.
Oh, yeah.
He received a few write-in votes in a race this past spring. And while it might be a little bit humorous, I think it just goes to show that people have other than having opinion polls go on about elections, and there's so many of them, but this is actually someone who gives them a reason to show up at the voting booth. And we don't have straight party ticket voting anymore. And people, Wisconsin are notorious ballot splitters. They'll go back and forth and back and forth in the general election to select the candidates they feel most comfortable with. Well, this would be a nice little zinger, I guess you'd say, if you're not happy with either of the major political parties. And I should note that in Nevada, it has been ruled constitutional. The Republican Party in Arizona took it to the federal appeals court, and they were rejected on the grounds that it was unconstitutional. And so it is a constitutional, none of the above approach, and I hope it's coming to a ballot near you soon.
Well, let's see if we can get in a quick call before the news. Johnny is first in Ladysmith. Hi, Johnny.
Yes. I'm just curious, as if you're going to implement a system like this to where someone's unhappy with who you're voting with, who their voice choice of voting for is, what good does it do if it's just another statistic that there's nothing back behind it, that something will happen? Let's say there's a gentleman that is on the ballot, the only one, and you vote that you're unhappy with the choice or that you're unhappy with him in particular. What good does it do if there's no sort of system set up that something will be done if there's a majority of people that aren't happy with the one person that they have to vote for?
Gotcha. Thank you, Johnny. So Johnny's suggesting here that maybe this option, none of the above, needs a little more teeth in it to make it satisfying or to make it useful. What do you think?
I guess I kind of agree with Johnny. I'm not a big fan of spending unlimited money in campaigns. I don't like the first Buckley v. Valeo or Citizens United or all the money that's third-party money that's being spent on elections. I feel they're out of control with the candidates themselves or the poor voters. If you turn on your TV, that's all you see are these campaign ads. I'm also in support of those measures of trying to change the way the system is run.
But this is a first step, a measurement, and I feel it's quite simple. Everybody can understand. You don't need to get a piece of literature in the mail about none of the above. It's sort of like one of those indicators of dissatisfaction that comes at no cost.
We're speaking right now with Wisconsin Senator from Milwaukee, Tim Carpenter, about his push to add a none-of-the-above option to Wisconsin's ballot. Almost half of the legislative seats in play this fall either have no major party challenger or are completely uncontested. The senator says a none-of-the-above vote would send a message that the public may be unhappy with the politician, even if they don't have a challenger.
And we'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see none-of-the-above on your ballot? What would it accomplish? Is there a race in which you would have liked to vote none of the above in the past or this November? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Wisconsin Senator from Milwaukee, Tim Carpenter, about his push to add a none-of-the-above option to Wisconsin's ballot. Almost half of the legislative seats in play this fall either have no major party challenger or they're completely uncontested. The senator says a none-of-the-above vote would send a message that the public may be unhappy with the politician, even if they don't have a challenger.
And we'd like to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think a none-of-the-above option would accomplish? Why do you think so many races in Wisconsin are uncontested in the first place? Would this help change that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're going to go to our phone lines now and take a call from Jana in Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi, Jana.
Hi. I would like to say that I think it's a nice idea that you offer the voters a chance to express themselves, but I think that in general it would be a really bad idea in terms of the way the numbers would come out, because research shows that it is usually the potential Democratic voter that is more easily discouraged from voting. And so in most cases, the Republican runner would win. And as a Democrat, I find that really troubling.
Okay, thank you, Jenna. What do you say to that, Tim?
Well, Jana, I understand. I'm a Democrat. I was born into the Democratic Party, shall we say, and I understand her concern. The problem also for Democrats is people are getting frustrated, and the more negative campaigns become, fewer Democrats tend to vote. And also, this last time around in Wisconsin, the Republicans had passed the redistricting plan. And they made it very polarized that I think of the seats that were done, seats with 55 to 45%, 10% difference is considered non-competitive. And so since 2000, 82% of all the seats in Wisconsin are considered non-competitive. And so while I am concerned about Democratic turnout, and I am a Democrat, I worry about that issue. And I also worry about the polarization that there's no middle ground. They're becoming endangered species, and I don't want them to become extinct. But either you have the far extreme left or the far extreme right. And legislating, that doesn't help us at all. It hinders the process.
We're talking right now with Wisconsin Senator Tim Carpenter from Milwaukee. He's got an idea to put a none-of-the-above option on the ballot so that voters can express their discontent with a candidate, even if that candidate wins, even if that candidate does not have a challenger. This is something that's already in effect in Nevada. Senator Carpenter would like to see it here in Wisconsin. We'll go back to our phones. Jerry joins us now from Menasha. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I stand 100% behind Senator Carpenter. It's about time we put none of the above on the ballot. People are so disillusioned, they don't feel their voices are being heard anyway. This way, at least their voices would be heard. Everybody's sick and tired of holding their noses, even when you have a non-contested race, and saying, we'll have to vote for the lesser of the two evils. This is a nationwide issue, and I think it's time that enough people said none of the above. It will start to shake up some of these complacent people who are either running unopposed or even if they are running opposed, to realize that they are not representing the best interests of their constituents.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Jerry. And I guess that's what you're looking to do here, Senator Carpenter, shake things up, maybe help politicians stop feeling complacent even if they're running unopposed. Is that what you're going for, what Jerry had to say?
Yep, Jerry's a great thinker. I agree with her. And those are the folks that we're trying to get to register folks so that they can vent their frustration and not give up on the system.
We're going to go next to Bill. Bill is with us in New Berlin. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I got to tell you, I think this whole discussion is nonsense. Every ballot has a place for a write-in candidate. So if they're running on a post or if there's nobody running, write your own name in. That's what I do every time.
Okay. Well, thanks, Bill. That's okay. So we've got a line where you can write in your own candidate. Shouldn't that suffice, says Bill, instead of going to all the trouble of a none-of-the-above option?
Well, the Republicans, this past two sessions, they passed 25, 30 different bills. One of them is, in order for those write-in votes to be counted, the individual has to have registered with the state elections board. So the Republicans, Senator Lossick, have thought of everything to try and neuter opinions. So you may see some scattering, but you won't see any names or anything like that. But none of the above, the intent would be to have it counted. And this way you don't have 20 different names. It's one solid figure, easy to read, none of the above, straightforward, and, no gimmicks. So that's why I feel it's necessary. But I understand what Bill's saying, and that's why the bill has been brought up, because of the loss of write-in votes.
Thank you so much for that call. And you can join us now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Would you like to see a none-of-the-above option on your ballot, or do you think it's not going to be very effective? Something you'd like to see that you think would increase civic participation? 800-642-1234. And we go next to Guy in West Allis. Hi, Guy.
Hi. My idea was that this none of the above thing would be a great option. And if the none of the above was the winner over both candidates, that the next one down would be able to serve their term, but they could not run again. They would have to be a fresh person in that field if they weren't actually the winner over none of the above.
All right. Some interesting thoughts there about how to tweak this a little, Senator Carpenter. What do you think about adding some extra bells and whistles to give this a little bit more real-world oomph to it?
Well, Guy lives in West Allis, and after redistricting, I represent, the eastern quarter of West Allis. So if he lives in the area east of, 73rd Street, he's a constituent of mine, and if he wants to show up and vote, either vote against me or write something in. Those are the people I wanted to get to. It's an idea to generate conversation. There can be a lot of amendments that are done to the bill, but I just wanted to use Nevada. And I should say also in Florida, there's an attempt to go ahead and have none of the above. Also, you have two very unpopular candidates, Governor Scott and former Governor Crist. Running, there's a libertarian who's very not well known, and there is discussion in Florida. It'll be too late for the November election about having none of the above in Florida. So I consider it a populist message, something that we need or we should consider.
Senator Carpenter, why do you think there are so many uncontested races here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think because the two-party system, the conditions haven't been right to have a third party create. And with all of this money that's being spent in campaigns It's absolutely absurd, and people are very frustrated with that. But the legislature itself, the Republicans who have controlled all the branches of government in the 2010 election, went through and rammed a very partisan redistricting plan. And so there are very few people that can run that are in, let's say, marginal seats. So it's kind of a hoax on the voters. I think the voters should elect their elected officials, not elected officials choosing their districts for them to be elected. And unfortunately, this time around, I think you'd have to go back 40, 50 years in Wisconsin that you had one party putting in a reapportionment map that has done this much damage. Otherwise, the courts have stepped in. And I should say, I agree with the Iowa model where you have a nonpartisan group that comes in and draw district boundary lines. I think that would go a long way in gaining people's trusts.
Let's get in one more quick caller here. Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. I agree with Jerry, Senator Carpenter, and Guy, and redistricting according to strict county lines or, you know, a grid, latitude and longitude, and just, you know, throw out the way that things are now. I would take this a step further. Voting should be mandatory. And if you don't vote, you pay a huge fine. That's where we can get our money to finance elections. And none of the above is the best option. If none of the above wins, the candidates who were not selected will not be able to run again.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom, for your thoughts. Senator Carpenter, lots of ideas on the table here for you to consider as you go forward. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You have a great week now. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Senator Tim Carpenter, we've been talking to. He's wanting to add a none-of-the-above option to the Wisconsin ballot. This fall, almost half of Wisconsin legislative seats in play are either uncontested or have no major party challenger.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in just a moment, we take a look at crossbow and archery deer hunting season in the state.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Fur trapping drove Wisconsin's economy for more than 200 years. Trapping remains a way of life for some Wisconsinites, including one man who runs a trapping store and teaches others how it's done.
I was probably 10, maybe 11, and we went to a rummage sale, and there was a pile of traps, and I describe it to people as they just kind of talk to me.
How you doing?
Okay.
Wonder if I could buy some traps.
I was 13 years old when I caught my first fox, and that was, wow. Couldn't even give me a Christmas present that good. I can still see it to this day.
Now, this little hole, I can just use some fox urine.
We've had the business now for six years. I like to put my fox urine back here, and then I'll put my lure at the top, and I'll put some bait if I have bait or if I want to use bait down the bottom.
What do you use for bait?
Herb Porter Special is really awesome. It started with a little bitty table in here with about $5,000 worth of stuff, which in this business isn't a lot. And I had a desk over there in the corner. Local trappers started coming in, and here we are. We're a full-blown trapping company. Okay, like, here we got some rat stretchers that we use for stretching rats that are wire. A lot of guys are switching over to the wood. We have, of course, our rubber gloves and aprons so that you're not full of grease when you're skinning. It's not like hunting, where if I wake up in the morning and it's cold and it's sleeting, freezing rain, I can't curl over and go, well, I'm going to go hunt tomorrow. I've got to get up and go run that line, no matter what. This is our lure room. This is where we have all our lures and baits and scents. It's a whole different world all its own. For instance, this is anchovy oil. I'm the only one that hasn't, that I have known of. and it is the freshest fish-smelling stuff that I have ever found. And then you get into the urines, believe it or not. Yes, we do. We carry urine. We carry red fox urine, coyote urine, wolf urine, bobcat urine. So you got to know when to use what. Nobody was able to teach me, and I learned myself. And that's why I spend so much time teaching. I get calls from all over the country all day long because of the videos that I put on the YouTube. They'll call me up and say, Tom, it was perfect. I caught two beavers the other day just like you said. And it makes me feel good to hear them all happy and excited. And now they got the trapping bug.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council and its Working Lives Project, where you can hear more from Wisconsin's working people. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
This weekend kicked off another Wisconsin wildlife tradition, the crossbow and archery deer hunting season. Patrick Durkin joins us now. He's a Wisconsin-based freelance outdoor writer. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, now, compared to the big event, the gun deer season, how big is the scale of archery deer hunting in Wisconsin?
Well, as far as numbers, it's the number of bull hunters in Wisconsin is about a third of the number of gun licenses sold. And, of course, most of the bull hunters also gun hunt, but it's about a third, and it tends to be a much more subtle opening than you ever see for gun season. You know, bull hunting, a lot of bull hunters I know don't even bother really getting serious about until around the third week of October and mid-October when they can't, basically that's when the deer start moving more. And, the early season, though, for a lot of us, it's still a fun time to get out there, and it's actually a very good time to hunt deer.
Now, this is the first year, a big change here. Anyone, as I understand it, can use a crossbow during this archery season. It used to be only people over 65 and people with disabilities could use crossbows. How is that going to change the archery hunting season?
I don't think it'll change things for most people. I think most people are going to keep hunting the way they've hunted. I know, like myself, I've been hunting with a compound bow since 1974, and before that I was hunting with a recurve bow, and I own a crossbow, but I really don't plan to use it until we get into the December archery season. And I think, for me, the reason is that crossbows, they're fun to shoot, but they're bulkier to carry around. They aren't as easy to maneuver up in a tree stand as a compound bow.
Now, I see there's been some criticism from at least some within the bow hunting community of this decision to open up crossbow hunting. Is this a big controversy or just a few outliers?
No, they're not outliers at all. There's a group of people who have long, very, very seriously, deeply opposed crossbows in the archery deer season. They don't. A lot of these folks don't consider crossbows to be archery equipment, even though they use a bow, they use a string, they use arrows, and you look at how the arrow is shot and how far it goes and how accurately it can be shot. They really aren't that much more accurate, and they really aren't that much longer ranged weapons than a bow. They're much more similar to a bow than they are to a gun. And the thing I've always argued, you can call it a gun all you want, just because it uses a rifle stock, to mount the bow. You can call it a gun, but it's not a gun. It's nothing comparable as far as the ballistics and its downrange performance.
But it is a little less physically challenging, and as I understand the entry training is a lot easier to get into a crossbow, which you just pull back and then you're pulling a trigger later, as opposed to a bow, which you're physically pulling back and aiming and whatnot.
Yeah, there's no doubt it's easier, and for some folks who are real big crossbow proponents, they look at that as a positive. If you're interested in getting people involved in hunting and making it something that they can do a little more easily, and especially these days, a lot of us don't live in areas where you can just go out in the backyard and shoot the bow and arrow. We have to go someplace to shoot it, and if you don't get the kind of time that people like me had when we were kids growing up, you don't have the opportunities to go out and have this real handy access to practice time. So that's one argument in favor of the crossbow, that it doesn't require the many hours it often takes some people to learn to master a bow. But the thing too to remember is that for me, the big jump in performance was from a recurve bow to a compound bow. And when I started shooting a compound bow, I mean, when I started shooting a crossbow, I didn't think it was that much more accurate, really, than I am with a compound bow. It's still, you know, you still have to, you know, use all the right muscles, study the thing. They aren't real easy things to hold real steady because they are bulkier and they have more parts sticking out in different angles. So it's not as easy as some folks make it seem.
Now, when it comes to the experience, whether you're out there with a bow or a crossbow, how does that hunting experience compare to hunting with a gun?
It's typically it's a much more relaxed environment. It's the thing that I always enjoy about it is you're really hunting the deer on their terms. You know, you have to do your scouting. You have to kind of know where the deer are going to be moving, you know, at least where you think they'll be moving. And deer and most wild game, they're not as predictable as you might think. You know, you think you got them figured out. Then the night you got your stand moved and where you think they're going to show that night or that morning, they don't show up. So it's always challenging. Whereas for me, gun season, in many parts of the state, you know, your success in gun season often depends on how many other people are around and where they're moving and where they're sitting, and it's much more man-driven than the archery season as far as the deer activity.
I wonder if the archery season might bring a different crowd into hunting. You had a popularity of shooting a bow and arrow a jump after the Hunger Games came out.
Sure.
I think it's Daryl is the character on the zombie show. The name just left my head, hunting with a crossbow.
Right.
Does that bring in people who are like, hey, that looks kind of cool, I want to check this out?
Yeah, it's been really interesting how many people took up archery, especially young ladies, teenage girls especially, wanted to start learning more about archery. I don't have the exact figures, but it was a pretty noticeable jump a lot of the archery shops noticed. And what's interesting about it for the archery industry is that these kids coming in wanting to learn and the women coming in wanting to learn, it's a whole different crowd than what they're used to dealing with. They're used to dealing with bow hunters for the most part. And this archery segment where they're more interested in shooting target archery and just learning the basics of a bow and understanding how different bows operate, that's a whole new audience that requires a little more time and teaching in a lot of the pro shops. You know, this is something they're learning themselves now, how to handle this new crowd and deal with them. And you know, of course, they're hoping that this interest will hang on and that the people won't just be a flash in the pan.
Pat, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You bet.
That was Patrick Durkin, Wisconsin-based freelance outdoor writer, with us to talk about the crossbow and archery deer hunting season, which just started this weekend.